You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, make sure you have pen and paper by your side. Tonight we're going to take another journey into the dark recesses of the lost light, if you can imagine such a thing. And I've already tipped my hand a little bit on tonight's broadcast, but I did not give it away. You'll recognize some of the beginning of this. So make sure that you're comfortable. Make sure that your mind is open. Make sure that you're ready to listen with a clear intellect. If you're not, you might as well go play kick the can out in the street with the local children. Because without the things that I've just told you to prepare yourself with, that's about as much good as it's going to do you. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is the age of deception, and we have been deceived and manipulated and lied to since the beginning of the dawn of human history by those who have slowly but surely over the years discovered how to do it, how to form their secret organizations to teach their followers how to do it, and they have been controlling the destiny of the human race ever since. They have been in charge, behind the scenes, but nevertheless, in charge. For those of you who really think that Bill Clinton is the one making all the decisions and calling the shots, well, I think you better think again. Those who put him there are the ones who are doing all of those things. Bill Clinton is just the one who will take either the wrath or the approval of the public, depending upon how they take what is being done. And everybody wants to impeach Bill Clinton, and I've got to ask you this, folks. What for? Why do you want to impeach Bill Clinton? He's just a figurehead. It's the people behind the throne that we should be going after, because once they are dealt with in a lawful manner, there will be no more Bill Clintons. There can be no more Bill Clintons if these people are put in prison where they belong. For they are treasonous little scoundrels, I can tell you that for sure. If you impeach Bill Clinton, who becomes president? Why, it's Al Gore. And if you impeach Al Gore, who becomes president then? Get out your constitutions, folks, and figure it out. You won't like that one either. And if you do, you're not playing with a full deck. You're going to lose this hand of poker. Stand by. Get ready. Get ready to shine the spotlight on the cockroaches hovering way back there in the dark behind the refrigerator. It's midnight, ladies and gentlemen. The ponderous bell in the church steeple slowly struck 12. You've heard this before, haven't you? Not too long ago, but you only heard a little bit of this. So settle back and get ready to be illumined. In the large auditorium of the sacred edifice, a crowd of people had assembled to witness the last obsequies of a titan. The angel of death brooded over the scene with shadowy wings. In the center of the room stood a catafalque draped in black, and resting upon it was a casket containing the mortal remains of a great soul. Arranged in triangles about the east, west, and south sides of the catafalque were burning tapers and tall candlesticks of silver. A huge iron cross was set at the head of this catafalque. Nearby stood a table covered with black velvet, upon which were 7 large candlesticks, but without the lights, a silver cup filled with salt, and a skull crowned with a laurel wreath. The gloom of the apartment was intensified by being hung with black cloth. The lights of the wax tapers illumined the face of the dead man, likewise the mocking skull wreathed with laurel, and brought into bold relief the iron cross. At the last stroke of the bell, an organ softly played a miserere, and there marched into the room from out of the Egyptian darkness a long file of men in somber uniforms, bearing lighted candles in their hands. They took their places about the catafalque, the venerable master at the head, near the Passion Cross. A trumpet sounded in the distance, and the services began. The venerable master struck with a sledge 3 times upon the iron cross and challenged anyone to present a charge against the dead man. There was no response, and the trial ended with the declaration that not man, but God only, is capable of judging the dead. Upon the remains were a chaplet of laurel, vines, and berries, representing living joy, a glittering cross representing glory and splendor, and a bunch of violets as a token of grief. All but the violets were removed, as it was declared the dead knight had passed beyond and above earthly pleasures, vainglory, and sorrows. The cords about the hands of the adept were untied, and those about the feet, symbolical of the release of the soul from the enslavement of the body. After a number of other significant offices were performed, the knights all knelt. The venerable master invoked the blessing upon the dead. The lights were extinguished one by one as the knights withdrew silently from the apartment. All Scottish Rite Masons will recognize in the description the funeral services of the 30th degree, the Knight of Kadash, which for weirdness and impressiveness is unsurpassed. The splendid degree of the Kadash portrays the trials and sufferings of Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master of the Knights Templars, who fell a victim to the machination of Philippe le Bel of France and Pope Clement V. De Molay and his fellows perished in the flames of the Inquisition. The Order of Knights Templars was accused of heresy, magic, and abominable practices. What was the real cause of this persecution? Quote, the avowed object of the Templars was to protect the Christians who came to visit the holy shrines of Palestine. Their secret object was the rebuilding of the Temple of Solomon on the model prophesied by Ezekiel, end quote. The secret superiors of the order were students of the Kabbalah, antagonistic to the dogmas of the church. The Masonic degree of Kadash is directed against temporal and spiritual tyranny. De Molay is the symbol of the good man persecuted, and the Masonic drama woven about him admonishes the candidate to arm himself against the encroachment of king or priest. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. The body in the coffin was that of General Albert Pike. For so many years, sovereign grand commander of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite for the southern jurisdiction of the United States. I shall never forget the impression made upon me by that splendid, awe-inspiring funeral service. I was not a Freemason at the time, but I secretly vowed to become one at the first favorable opportunity. Often had I seen General Pike in the streets of Washington, his snow-white hair falling about his shoulders like the mane of a lion, his broad, expansive forehead, his serene countenance, his powerful frame awoke thoughts in me of some far-off time. The conventional dress of an American citizen did not seem suited to such a splendid personality. The costume of an ancient Greek would have been more in keeping with such a face and figure, such a habit as Plato wore when he discoursed upon divine philosophy to his students among the groves of the Academy of Athens beneath the brilliant sun of Greece. Who knows but that Albert Pike was not a reincarnation of Plato walking these 19th century streets of ours. Plato was so named, it is said, because of his broad shoulders. Plato was distinguished for manly beauty. Quote, to creative imagination of the first order, he added logical, analytical, and constructive powers. Above all, he was penetrated with the conviction of a harmony in the universe of being, which led to the conception of a high ideal of life and supplied him with the strength of purpose consistently to maintain it. End quote. To convince men of God, the soul, and immortality was the great purpose of Plato and his philosophy. How like unto Plato in character and ideals was Albert Pike. I never met this great thinker, Pike, this real master of the veils, as Buck calls him in his mystic masonry. I knew him by sight only, and the very last time I set eyes upon him was at that weird midnight funeral of the Kaddish, when he lay so peacefully in his coffin, the lights of the wax tapers shining upon him, his face frozen into that icy calm which we call death, his hands and feet bound with the symbolical cords from which he was finally released by the knights, the cords typical of the thraldom of human nature to the passions of this mortal career, of the soul to its body. But the great soul had already winged its flight to more subtle spheres of spirit, bursting the doors of its sepulchre of clay like the golden butterfly, its chrysalis. The splendor of that face, even in death, framed in by its wealth of snow-white hair, made a picture that shall live long in my memory. I said to myself, here lies the apostle of liberty, equality, and fraternity, against whom the Vatican launched its thunders, and who stood up like Olympian Jove and hurled back at Rome the thunderbolt of the Masonic hierarchy, anathema for anathema, encyclical for encyclical. Even after his death, his memory was aspersed by Jesuiter evil writers. Gabriel Jogan Pages, the arch-liar of the 19th century, hoodwinked the church into believing that Masonry was the very spawn of the devil, that its inner circles did homage to Satan and practiced the black mass, and that Beelzebub's vice-regent on earth was General Albert Pike. The Catholic press of Europe reeked with absurd and abominable stories until Pages acknowledged his imposture. General Pike was a profound student of philosophy, philology, comparative religions, ancient symbolism, occult imitations, and the Kabbalah. He was a master of Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and other languages, classical and modern. In his old age, he translated the Rig Veda, the Zend Avesta, and other sacred books of Aryan literature with comments. 18 manuscript volumes of these translations are in the possession of the Supreme Council at Washington. This was the crowning glory of a life of usefulness. Perhaps the most difficult language in the world to acquire is the old Sanskrit of our Aryan ancestors. But Pike, when upwards of 70 years of age, learned Sanskrit in order to translate the Vedas. His studies in the theosophies of the Orient convinced him that the true word of a master mason was traceable to Aryan and Indo-Aryan sources from which it filtered into Egypt and other countries. From the land of the Mizraim, it was absorbed into the Kabbalah of the Jews. Greece and Rome preserved it in their mysteries. Masonry inherited it from the Kabbalah. The true word of a master is the ineffable name of God about which so many legends cluster. According to sacred writ, it was communicated by the deity to Moses upon Mount Horeb. But the adepts of India, Chaldea, Persia, and Egypt were in possession of this sacred name. Tradition says that its pronunciation caused the earth to quake and the angels of heaven to tremble with fear. It was a word of power. But its true meaning and pronunciation has been lost to the world. The idea of masonry is to recover this word, which was known to Solomon, Hiram, king of Tyre, and Hiram, the widow's son, the three grand masters of the temple. But let us not mistake allegory for fact, the symbol for the thing symbolized. The last word is a symbol of the occult doctrine which treats of the nature and attributes of the great first cause and man's relation thereto. That doctrine, which runs like a vein of gold through the mountains of superstition, myth, and allegory, the secret doctrine taught to the initiates of the temples. Says Pike, quote, "The ineffable name not only embodies the great philosophical idea that the deity is the ends, the to-on, the absolute existence, that of which the essence is to exist, the only substance of Spinoza, the being that never could not have existed, as contradistinguished from that which only becomes, not nature or the soul of nature, but that which created nature, but also the idea of the male and female principles in its highest and most profound sense, to wit, that God originally comprehended in himself all that is, that matter was not coexistent with him or independent of him, that he did not merely fashion and shape a pre-existing chaos into a universe, but that his thought manifested itself outwardly in that universe, which so became and before was not, except as comprehended in him, that the generative power or spirit and the productive matter ever among the ancients deemed the female originally were in God, and that he was and is all that was and is and that shall be in whom all else lives, moves, and has its being. This was the great mystery of the ineffable name. And of course, its true pronunciation and its meaning became lost to all except the select few to whom it was confided. It being concealed from the common people, because the deity thus metaphysically named was not that personal and capricious and as it were tangible God in whom they believed and who alone was within reach of their rude capacities. This was the profound truth, hidden in the ancient allegory and covered from the general view with a double veil. This was the exoteric meaning of the generation and production of the Indian, Chaldean, and Phoenician cosmogonies, of the active and passive powers, of the male and female principles, of heaven and its luminaries generating, and the earth producing, all hidden from vulgar view as above its comprehension. The doctrine that matter is not eternal, but that God was the only original existence, the absolute from whom everything has proceeded and to whom all returns. And this true word is with entire accuracy said to have been lost because its meaning was lost, even among the Hebrews, although we still find the name, its real meaning unsuspected, in the Hu of the Druids and Fohai of the Chinese, that can be found in Morals and Dogma, page 700, et sec. Albert Pike, held correctly that this occult doctrine is contained in the symbols of the first three degrees of Masonry, known as the Blue Lodge, but that the neophyte does not obtain it until he enters the sanctum sanctoria of the Scottish Rite, and then only after deep study and contemplation. The Blue Lodge bears the same relationship to the Scottish Rite that the lesser mysteries of Egypt did to the greater mysteries. In the former, the symbols are covered to the neophyte, only a few trite ethical explanations of them being imparted to him. In the latter, Isis is unveiled, and the glory of the goddess is seen by the devout initiate. In other words, the candidate passes from the square, which is the symbol of the earthly and material, to the compasses, which is the symbol of the heavenly and spiritual. From science to philosophy. Science is the collating of facts. Philosophy is the most modern acceptation of the term, is a synthesis of all facts. The endeavor to reduce the many to unity and to discover, if possible, the principles upon which things are based. But there are two schools of philosophy. Two schools of philosophy, one materialistic, interpreting nature and man in terms of unconscious force, mechanical, atheistic. The other, the idealistic, which posits a psychic principle as the foundation of all things and interprets nature and man in terms of spirit. Masonry is wedded to the latter worldview and follows in the footsteps of Plato, Pythagoras, the Hindu sages and modern thinkers like Descartes, Leibniz, Martineau, Goethe, Fiske, etc. Albert Pike is its greatest expounder. His work, The Morals and Dogma of the Scottish Rite, is a mine of information, as well as a monument to its author, which will outlive any giant pyramid of stone that could be erected. There is a powerful chapter in Victor Hugo's Notre Dame, in which Claude Frollo, the archdeacon, a dabbler in alchemy, entertains several old cronies in his cell in the cloister of the cathedral. Upon his table lies a printed book, one of the products of Gutenberg's press. Opening the window of his cell, the archdeacon, pointing his finger at the immense Notre Dame, which looms up against the starry sky like an enormous two-headed sphinx, and laying his hand upon the volume on the table, utters the enigmatic sentence, quote, "This will kill that." End quote. In other words, printing will kill architecture. In the old days, great temples were Bibles in stone, built to perpetuate the memory of men and the ideas of their epoch. But the Bible of paper is not only cheaper, but capable of infinite duplication. It will eventually kill the stone Bible. An insignificant marble marks the last resting place of Albert Pike in Oak Hill Cemetery, Washington, D.C. The superficial observer may wonder that the Masons of the United States did not erect a magnificent mausoleum for the repose of the bones of its greatest adept. A splendid sarcophagus of Egyptian marble, upheld by four winged sphinxes, with a stone canopy over the whole supported by ponderous pillars, might easily have been built. But Pike needs none such Bible of stone to perpetuate his memory. His literary works are his most enduring monument. A great book will outlast the pyramids of Egypt. Every Freemason who takes the 14th degree of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite for the southern jurisdiction, which includes all the states west of the Mississippi River, the insular possessions of the United States, and the Army and Navy, receives a copy of The Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike, which is published by the Supreme Council of the Order at Washington. It is a volume of 861 pages, closely printed and illustrated with symbols. The Morals and Dogma is professedly a commentary on the various degrees of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, from entered apprentice to the 32nd degree, inclusive. But it is much more than that. It is a study of comparative religions and symbology, a lofty treatise on ethics, an unfolding of the occult doctrines of the ancient world, as well as a work on philosophy. It has necessarily been compiled from many sources. The thoughts of the ancient sages adorn its pages, but upon every page we also see the stamp of Albert Pike's original creative genius. The style, though diffuse at times, is distinguished by poetic fire and a noble simplicity. It carries conviction with it. To Eliphas Levi, a French mystic and Kabbalist, Pike was much indebted. Long before any of Levi's writings were translated into English, General Pike was reading them with avidity. In compiling The Knight of the Sun, or Prince Adept, the 28th degree of the right, Albert Pike borrowed from Levi's work on occulture a number of the latter's symbolical figures. A few extants from the Morals and Dogma will show the lofty thought contained therein. Though Masonry neither usurps the place of nor apes religion, prayer is an essential part of our ceremonies. It is the aspiration of the soul toward the absolute and infinite intelligence, which is the one supreme deity, most feebly and misunderstandingly characterized as an architect. Certain faculties of man are directed toward the unknown, thought, meditation, prayer. The unknown is an ocean of which conscience is the compass. Thought, meditation, prayer are the great mysterious pointings of the needle. It is a spiritual magnetism that thus connects the human soul with the deity. These majestic irradiations of the soul pierce through the shadow toward the light. Ladies and gentlemen, it is in Pike's monumental work, Morals and Dogma, that he reveals to the brothers of Freemasonry that their religion, and he calls it a religion, is the Luciferian philosophy. That man was held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust and vindictive, terrible God. That he was set free by the gift of intellect, by and that God had lied to them to hold them prisoner to tend to the garden, when in fact they could become as gods. And that is the promise of Freemasonry. It is the promise of Satan. It is the promise of Albert Pike. I suggest that you look up a copy of Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma. You can find hundreds of them in used bookstores. Get one while the getting's good. Because I understand that the Brotherhood is attempting to buy them all up. And if you ask them about what Pike says, they claim that Pike never spoke for Freemasonry. And that no man speaks for Freemasonry. Ladies and gentlemen, that is just another one of their thousands and millions of lies. For he was the Grand Inspector General of the Council of the 33rd Degree of the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, the supreme post of the order. In this country, and some say in the world. The universe that Pike speaks of as the great Bible of God, quote, material nature is its Old Testament, millions of years old, thick with eternal truths under our feet, glittering with everlasting glories over our heads, and human nature is the New Testament from the infinite God every day revealing a new page as time turns over the leaves. Everything is a thought of the infinite God. Nature is his prose and man his poetry. End quote. The grand objects of nature perpetually constrain men to think of their author. The Alps are the great altar of Europe. The nocturnal sky has been to mankind the dome of a temple starred all over with admonitions to reverence, trust, and love. Science gratifies the religious feeling without arresting it and opens out the unfathomable mystery of the One Supreme into more explicit and manageable forms, which express not indeed His essence, which is wholly beyond our reach and higher than our faculties can climb, but His will, and so feeds an endless enthusiasm by accumulating forever new objects of pursuit. We have long experienced that knowledge is profitable. We are beginning to find out that it is moral, and we shall at last discover it to be religious, end quote. For the true religion of which they speak, ladies and gentlemen, is neither Lucifer or Jehovah or Adonai or El or any of the other names that you may call whatever your version of God may be, but it is that flame, that fire known as the intellect of man, through the use of which man himself will become God. That is the truth of the lost light, the lost word of Freemasonry. In the following discourse is contained the very quintessence of philosophy and religion according to the Brotherhood. Quote, doubt in presence of being and its harmonies, skepticism in the face of the eternal mathematics and the immutable laws of life, which make the divinity present and visible everywhere, as the human is known and visible by its utterances of word and act, is this not the most foolish of superstitions and the most inexcusable as well as the most dangerous of all credulities? Let me read that again to you, folks, so that you can ponder it. This, they believe, is the very quintessence of philosophy and religion. Quote, doubt in presence of being and its harmonies, skepticism in the face of the eternal mathematics and the immutable laws of life which make the divinity present and visible everywhere, as the human is known and visible by its utterances of word and act, is this not the most foolish of superstitions and the most inexcusable as well as the most dangerous of all credulities? Thought, we know, is not a result or consequence of the organization of matter, of the chemical or other action or reaction of its particles, like effervescence and gaseous explosions. On the contrary, the fact that thought is manifested and realized in act human or act divine proves the existence of an entity or unity that thinks. And the universe is the infinite utterance of one of an infinite number of infinite thoughts, which cannot but emanate from an infinite and thinking source. The cause is always equal, at least to the effect. And matter cannot think, nor could it cause itself, or exist without cause, nor could nothing produce either forces or things. For in void nothingness, no forces can inhere. Admit a self-existent force and its intelligence, or an intelligence cause of it, as admitted and at once God is. Albert Pike had a horror of atheism as a philosophic creed. He agreed with Jean-Paul Richter, who speaks of the atheist as living alone in the world, with a heart empty and made desolate by the loss of his creator and father. He mourns by the side of the huge corpse of nature, which no spirit animates as it lingers in the tomb, and his sorrow shall continue to the moment when dissolution severs him from this corpse, of which he is but an atom. The world poses before him like an Egyptian sphinx, half buried in sand, and the universe is but a mask, the iron mask of a vague eternity. Briefly told, Albert Pike's life is as follows. He was born in Boston, Massachusetts, December 29, 1809, and was educated at Harvard. For some years, he engaged in teaching. In 1831, he accompanied an expedition to Santa Fe and subsequently explored the headwaters of the Red and Brazos Rivers. In December 1832, we find him located at Fort Smith, Arkansas. He edited the Arkansas Advocate in 1833 to 1836 and was admitted to the bar. He commanded a squadron in the Mexican War and fought at Buena Vista. In 1847, he received the surrender at Mapami when, in the Civil War, broke out the Confederate government appointed him Indian Commissioner and later Brigadier General. After the war, he practiced law in Memphis and edited the Memphis Appeal from 1867 to 68. In the year 1868, he removed to Washington, where he practiced law until 1880, after which period he devoted his time to the Scottish Rite, revising and elaborating the rituals of the old French degree and writing the philosophical lectures to accompany them, also engaging in other literary labors of a Masonic character. In his 20th year, General Pike wrote his Hymns to the Gods. Notice that's Hymns to the Gods, plural, published in Blackwood's Magazine in 1839, thus establishing his reputation as a poet of the first rank. There were subsequently included in Nagai, a volume of poems privately printed in 1854. In 1873 and 1882, he issued two other collections of poems, which were privately printed. The Battle Hymn of the Confederacy was written by Pike to the heir of Dixie. During his career as a lawyer, Pike wrote a number of law books of value, but his reputation was established by his Morals and Dogma, 1870, and his remarkable poems. In a chapter of Royal Arch Masons, there are three officers who bear the title of Master of the Veils. These veils are, like those of the tabernacle set up in the wilderness, of four colors: blue, purple, scarlet, and white. Josephus says that they represented the four elements. Each master of a veil is armed with a sword and bears a banner of the appropriate color. One of them is stationed at the blue, another at the purple, and yet another at the scarlet veil. It is the Royal Ark Captain, however, who guards the white veil. This, ladies and gentlemen, was written by a Freemason of the 33rd degree of the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, Henry Ridgely Evans. and it is entitled The Master of the Veils. It was printed in the official magazine for the Supreme Council of the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, entitled The New Age. This appeared in volume number 9, that's Roman numeral 9, June 1908 to December 1908. Should you wish to look it up. Should you also wish to explore the true writings of General Albert Pike, you'll find that he was not a Christian. You'll find that the God that he believed in, ladies and gentlemen, was not the God of the Bible, for he believed that that Bible represented a God who was vicious and cruel, and that man's true Savior was not Jesus Christ, whom you will find was never mentioned in any of that article, is never mentioned in any of the writings of General Albert Pike. But he does make frequent reference to his true God and his true Savior, the one that he believes through the interpretation of the mystery religion of the account of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden to be Lucifer, who set man free from the imprisonment in the garden, and his caretaking, innocent, and thus stupid status brought him the gift of fire, intellect, so that man himself could know good and evil. And through the use of that intellect and his experience through the ages, partaking of the good and the evil, will someday himself become God. That is the true lost word, lost light. That is the truth of these secret fraternal orders. I doubt seriously if anybody at the lower degrees knows anything about any of it. And that is why they have the pyramidal structure of degrees, and there are so few at the top and so many at the bottom. That is why they must take blood oaths to protect the secrets, to protect the brotherhood, and to protect each other. They are consummate liars. I have no beef with their religion, for they have a right to practice whichever religion they wish, ladies and gentlemen. Their ultimate accounting will be to God, not to me. My beef with them is in their lying to the rest of us, in their gross deceptions to guide humanity in a direction which we may not wish to go, in their tremendous unfairness in giving their fellow brothers the deal over the man who is not a fellow brother, and in giving the grossest convictions and awards in courts of law to those who they call the profane, while letting their brothers go free, or letting them off with a pat on the hand, or a small fine, or a very short sentence, and huge rewards in civil cases. You'll find that most judges, not all, most judges in city, state, and federal courts belong to one or other of the fraternal orders which harbor at the highest degrees those known as the Illuminati. The ones who believe themselves to be the receptacles of the only truly mature minds, and thus the only ones, they say, rightfully destined to rule the cattle, which is you and I. as much due diligence as they have practiced to attempt to keep all of this a secret, ladies and gentlemen, over the hundreds and thousands of years of their existence, it has crept out in writings and in hieroglyphic reliefs, in books, in symbols, in ceremonies, in the relief and in the buildings of ancient and modern architecture. They made reference in the article that the ancient cathedrals were the Bibles of the day, where the religion was recorded in the edifice in stone. What they don't tell you, that when the ancient cathedrals of Europe were dismantled over the years, one by one, to be cleaned and rebuilt and shored up to make them safer for modern congregations and for tourists and for history, when the great slab stone was lifted from the top of the altar, and each and every one was found a great stone penis, the phallus of Osiris. And I could go on and on and on, and this is all a matter of historical record. But read Morals and Dogma. Read everything that you can by Albert Pike. You'll find that he is acknowledged in the works of Freemasons everywhere as the greatest Freemason who has ever lived, and the one who opened up the lost word so that they could all understand it more easily. And if you read his works diligently, your mind will suddenly see a glimmer through the fog. As you walk toward that glimmer and you study his works more, you will see that the fog will part. And there truly indeed will be a light, ladies and gentlemen, but it will be the light of your intellect shining upon the black light of the lies of Freemasonry, and will reveal to you that Lucifer is their God. But not in any sense of reality, for they do not acknowledge that there is a Lucifer, or a Jehovah, or an Adonai, or a Yahweh. They believe that their God is themselves. That all of these other things are just symbols, metaphors, and allegories. Veils, if you will. Veils that hide the truth from all but the very highest degrees, the most studied of the brotherhood, those that are admitted to the very sacrosanct caverns and groves, if you will. And only those who have studied the symbology of the mysteries will understand what I just said. And I said it purposely for them. To ultimately disappear behind the veil themselves and to become one of the thousand points of light. Working toward the completion of the great work. The final examination of the grand experiment, to place their king upon the throne of the world. They will do this when they have eliminated all existing religions, save theirs, and you will notice that all religions in the world are changing now, coming closer together, becoming more humanistic in their thinking, practicing what's known as liberation theology, which, ladies and gentlemen, is nothing more than Marxism, and Marxism renounces God. The ultimate end of the blending of all of this and the coming together will be the practice of the religion of Freemasonry. which is itself the ancient religion of Babylon. Reborn in the modern age, after it has been kept hidden. Kept hidden, ladies and gentlemen, in the little boat made of reeds, floating through the waters of life, until it is found by the handmaiden of Pharaoh's daughter, who will then take the young babe Horus out, walk it to the farthest extent of Pride Rock, and hold it aloft for all to see. And then, ladies and gentlemen, there will be no more nation states. There will be no more wars. There will be no more various religions scattered throughout the world. There will be no more than 500 million people upon the face of this earth. And there will never be allowed to be any more than that number. And there will be no more freedom for anyone. Information will be controlled. History will disappear and be rewritten, so there will be no memory of what has gone before. And there will be no hope of deliverance, for the technology that they are developing in secret will be the most terrible weapons of destruction for those who will oppose the great new utopian socialist world order that has ever been contemplated in the mind of man in the history of this world, and can little be imagined. It's not too late to turn it around. But based upon my observations and my experience, no such thing will happen. No such thing will happen, ladies and gentlemen. And when they begin to squeeze the pinchers and disarm the American people and bring together this utopian socialist order upon the ashes of what once was the greatest nation upon the face of this earth, bar none in the history of the world, and the freest, most educated, most well-off people who have ever lived upon this earth, a small handful of men like me and women will stand and fight the last battle for freedom. It will be a long battle, and it will be fought over many years. And there will be a lot of crying and suffering. And I haven't the slightest idea who's going to win that battle, ladies and gentlemen. But I know something from my study of the world and its history. Those who fight for ideas and who are willing to die for those ideas have never been beaten in the history of the world, not once. Those who fight for a paycheck and a promise of a retirement are the easiest armies to defeat and always have been, regardless of the magnitude or the terror of their weapons. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Think about tonight's episode of The Hour of the Time, and determine what it is that you will do. Will you bend down and place the chains around your own ankles and march docilely into your enslavement? Or will you join with those of us who will fight that last battle for freedom? You see, you're going to die someday anyway. Why not die for something that's right and something that's good, if you're going to die? And I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, despite the fact that some may think they are God, we are all going to die. God bless each and every single one of you. The bell is tolling, and it's tolling for you, and you had better listen. And now, ladies and gentlemen, you know why William Jefferson Clinton called me, William Cooper, the most dangerous radio host in America. For I am the greatest enemy that socialism has ever known. And the only weapon that I wield is truth. Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network.
The Hour of the Time may be contacted at HOT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, in the state of Arizona, 85925. Our phone number is 928-333-2942, and our website is www.hourofthetime.com.